vexed. Burnham saw his family rarely now. By the spring of 1891, he was living full-time in the shanty at Jackson Park. Margaret stayed in Evanston with a few servants who helped her care for their five children. Only a modest train ride separated the Burnhams, but the mounting demands of the fair made that distance as difficult to span as the Isthmus of Panama. Burnham could send telegrams, but these forced a cold and clumsy brevity and afforded little privacy. So Burnham wrote letters and wrote them often. "You must not think this hurry of my life will last forever," he wrote in one letter. "I shall stop after the World's Fair. I have made up my mind to this." The exposition had become a hurricane, he said. "To be done with this flurry is my strongest wish." Every dawn, he left his quarters and inspected the grounds. Six steam-powered dredges the size of floating barns gnawed at the lakeshore, as 5,000 men with shovels and wheelbarrows and horse-drawn graders slowly scraped the landscape raw, many of the men wearing bowlers and suit coats as if they just happened to be passing by, and on impulse chose to pitch in. Despite the presence of so many workers, there was a maddening lack of noise and bustle. The park was too big, the men too spread out to deliver any immediate sense of work being done. The only reliable signs were the black plumes of smoke from the dredges and the ever-present scent of burning leaves from slash piles set aflame by workers. The brilliant white stakes that marked the perimeters of buildings imparted to the land the look of a Civil War burial ground. Burnham did find beauty in the rawness. Among the trees of the wooded island, the long white tents of the contractor's camp gleamed in the sun, a soft white note in the dun-colored landscape, and the pure blue line of the lake horizon made a cheerful contrast to the rugged and barren foreground. But he also found deep frustration. The exposition was like a great ocean liner powered by a single sail, that sail being Burnham. The work advanced slowly, impeded by the worsening relationship between the fair's two ruling bodies, the National Commission and the Exposition Company, and by the architect's failure to get their drawings to Chicago on time. All the drawings were late. Equally aggravating was the fact there still was no Eiffel Challenger. Moreover, the exposition had entered that precarious early phase common to every great construction project when unexpected obstacles suddenly emerge. Burnham knew how to deal with Chicago's notoriously flimsy soil, but Jackson Park surprised even him. Initially, the bearing capacity of its ground was practically an unknown quality, as one engineer put it. In March 1891, Burnham ordered tests to gauge how well the soil would support the grand palaces then on the architect's drafting tables. Of special concern was the fact that the buildings would be sited adjacent to newly dug canals and lagoons. As any engineer knew, soil under pressure tended to shift to fill adjacent excavations. The fair's engineers conducted the first test 12 feet from the lagoon on ground intended to support the northeast corner of the electricity building. They laid a platform 4 feet square and loaded it with iron to a pressure of 2,750 pounds per square foot, 22 tons in all. They left it in place for 15 days and found it settled only 1/4 inch. Next, they dug a deep trench 4 feet from the platform. Over the next 2 days, the platform sank another 1/8 inch, but no farther. This was good news. It meant that Burnham could use Root's floating grillage for foundations without having to worry about catastrophic settlement. To make sure these properties were constant throughout the park, Burnham had his chief engineer, Abraham Gottlieb, test locations earmarked for other buildings. The tests yielded similar results until Gottlieb's men came to the site intended for Henry Post's gigantic manufacturers and liberal arts building. The soil destined to support the northern half of the building showed total settlement of less than 1 inch, consistent with the rest of the park. At the southern end of the site, however, the men made a disheartening discovery. Even as workers loaded the platform, it sank 8 inches. Over the next 4 days, it settled 30 inches more and would have continued sinking if the engineers had not simply called off the test. Of course, nearly all the soil of Jackson Park was competent to support floating foundations, except the one portion destined to bear the fair's biggest and heaviest building. Here, Burnham realized, contractors would have to drive piles at least down to Hardpan, an expensive complication and a source of additional delay. The problems with this building, however, had only just begun. In April 1891, Chicago learned the results of the latest mayoral election. In the city's richest clubs, industrialists gathered to toast the fact that Carter Henry Harrison, whom they viewed as overly sympathetic to organized labor, had lost to Hempstead Washburn, a Republican. Burnham, too, allowed himself a moment of celebration. To him, Harrison represented the old Chicago of filth, smoke, and vice, everything the fair was designed to repudiate. The celebrations were tempered, however, by the fact that Harrison had lost by the narrowest of margins, fewer than 4,000 votes, and what's more, had achieved this near victory without the support of a major party. Shunned by the Democrats, he had run as an independent. Elsewhere in the city, Patrick Prendergast grieved. Harrison was his hero, his hope. The margin was so narrow, however, that he believed if Harrison ran again, he would win. Prendergast resolved to double his own efforts to help Harrison succeed. In Jackson Park, Burnham faced repeated interruptions stemming from his de facto role as ambassador to the outside world, charged with cultivating goodwill and future attendance. Mostly these banquets, talks, and tours were time-squandering annoyances, as in June 1891, when, at the request of Director General Davis, Burnham hosted a visit to Jackson Park by a battalion of foreign dignitaries that consumed 2 full days. Others were purely a pleasure. A few weeks earlier, Thomas Edison, known widely as the Wizard of Menlo Park, had paid a visit to Burnham's shanty. Burnham showed him around. Edison suggested the exposition use incandescent bulbs rather than arc lights, because the incandescent variety produced a softer light. Where arc lights could not be avoided, he said, they should be covered with white globes. And, of course, Edison urged the fair to use direct current, DC, the prevailing standard. The civility of this encounter belied a caustic battle being waged outside Jackson Park for the rights to illuminate the exposition. On one side was General Electric Company, which was created when J.P. Morgan took over Edison's company and merged it with several others, and which now proposed to install a direct current system to light the fair. On the other side was Westinghouse Electric Company, with a bid to wire Jackson Park for alternating current, using patents its founder, George Westinghouse, had acquired a few years earlier from Nikola Tesla. General Electric offered to do the job for $1.8 million, insisting the deal would not earn a penny's profit. A number of exposition directors held General Electric stock and urged William Baker, president of the fair since Lyman Gage's April retirement, to accept the bid. Baker refused, calling it extortionate. General Electric rather miraculously came back with a bid of $554,000. But Westinghouse, whose AC system was inherently cheaper and more efficient, bid $399,000. The exposition went with Westinghouse and helped change the history of electricity. The source of Burnham's greatest dismay was the failure of the architects to finish their drawings on schedule. If he had once been obsequious to Richard Hunt and the Eastern men, he was not now. In a June 2, 1891 letter to Hunt, he wrote, We are at a dead standstill waiting for your scale drawings. Can't we have them as they are and finish here? 4 days later, he again prodded Hunt. The delay you are causing us by not forwarding scale drawings is embarrassing in the extreme. To Peabody. We are completely put out with the delay on your building. That same month, a serious, if unavoidable, interruption hobbled the landscape department. Olmsted became ill. Severely so. He attributed his condition to poisoning from an arsenic-based pigment called turkey red in the wallpaper of his Brookline home. It may, however, simply have been another bout of deep blue melancholia, the kind that had assailed him off and on for years. During his recuperation, Olmsted ordered bulbs and plants for cultivation in two large nurseries established on the fairgrounds. He ordered Dusty Miller, Carpet Bugle, President Garfield Heliotrope, Speedwell, Penny Royal, English and Algerian ivies, verbena, vinca, and a rich palette of geraniums, among them Black Prince, Christopher Columbus, Mrs. Turner, Crystal Palace, Happy Thought, and Jeanne d'Arc. He dispatched an army of collectors to the shores of Lake Calumet, where they gathered 27 train car loads of iris, sedge, bulrush, and other semi-aquatic plants and grasses. They collected an additional 4,000 crates of pond lily roots, which Olmsted's men quickly planted, only to watch most of the roots succumb to the ever-changing levels of the lake. In contrast to the lush growth within the nurseries, the grounds of the park had been scraped free of all vegetation. Workers enriched the soil with 1,000 carloads of manure shipped from the Union stockyards, and another 2,000 collected from the horses working in Jackson Park. So much exposed earth and manure became a problem. It was bad enough during the hot weather when a south wind could blind the eyes of man and beast, wrote Rudolf Ulrich, Olmsted's landscape superintendent at the park, but still worse during wet weather, the newly filled ground, which was still undrained, becoming soaked with water. Horses sank to their bellies. It was midsummer 1891 by the time the last of the architect's drawings was completed. As each set came in, Burnham advertised for bids. Recognizing that the architect's delays had put everything behind schedule, he inserted into the construction contracts clauses that made him a czar, as the Chicago Tribune put it. Each contract contained a tight deadline for completion, with a financial penalty for every day beyond. Burnham had advertised the first contract on May 14th, this for the mines and mining building. He wanted it finished by the end of the year. That left, at best, about 7 months for construction, roughly the amount of time a 21st-century homeowner would need to build a new garage. He is the arbiter of all disputes, and no provision is made for an appeal from his decision, the Tribune reported. If, in the opinion of Mr. Burnham, the builder is not employing a sufficient force of men to complete the work on time, Mr. Burnham is authorized to engage men himself and charge the cost to the builder. The mines building was the first of the main exposition buildings to begin construction, but the work did not start until July 3, 1891, with less than 16 months remaining until dedication day. As construction of the buildings at last got underway, anticipation outside the park began to increase. Colonel William Cody, Buffalo Bill, sought a concession for his Wild West show, newly returned from a hugely successful tour of Europe. But the fair's Committee on Ways and Means turned him down on grounds of incongruity. Undeterred, Cody secured rights to a large parcel of land adjacent to the park. In San Francisco, a 21-year-old entrepreneur named Saul Bloom realized the Chicago Fair would let him, at last, take advantage of an asset he had acquired in Paris 2 years earlier. Entranced by the Algerian village at the Paris Exposition, he had bought the rights to display the village and its inhabitants at future events. The Ways and Means Committee rejected him, too. He returned to San Francisco intent on trying a different, more oblique means of winning a concession, one that ultimately would get him a lot more than he had bargained for. Meanwhile, young Lieutenant Shufeld had reached Zanzibar. On July 20th, he telegraphed Exposition President William Baker that he was confident he could acquire as many pygmies from the Congo as he wished, provided the King of Belgium consented. "President Baker wants these pygmies," the Tribune said, "and so does everybody else around headquarters." On the drafting board, the fair did look spectacular. The centerpiece was the Grand Court, which everyone had begun calling the Court of Honor. With its immense palaces by Hunt, Post, Peabody, and the rest, the court by itself would be a marvel. But now nearly every state in the nation was planning a building, as were some 200 companies and foreign governments. The exposition promised to surpass the Paris Exposition on every level. Every level, that is, except one. And that persistent deficit troubled Burnham. The fair still had nothing planned that would equal, let alone eclipse, the Eiffel Tower. At nearly 1,000 feet in height, the tower remained the tallest structure in the world and an insufferable reminder of the triumph of the Paris Exposition. To out-Eiffel Eiffel had become a battle cry among the directors. A competition held by the Tribune brought a wave of implausible proposals. C.F. Richel of Bridgeport, Connecticut, suggested a tower with a base 100 feet high by 500 feet wide, within which Richel proposed to nest a second tower, and in this one, a third. At intervals, a complicated system of hydraulic tubes and pumps would cause the towers to telescope slowly upward, a journey of several hours, then allow them to sink slowly back to their original configuration. The top of the tower would house a restaurant, although possibly a bordello would have been more apt. Another inventor, J.B. McComber, representing the Chicago Tower Spiral Spring Ascension and Toboggan Transportation Company, proposed a tower with a height of 8,947 feet, nearly nine times the height of the Eiffel Tower, with a base 1,000 feet in diameter sunk 2,000 feet into the earth. Elevated rails would lead from the top of the tower all the way to New York, Boston, Baltimore, and other cities. Visitors ready to conclude their visit to the fair and daring enough to ride elevators to the top would then toboggan all the way back home. "As the cost of the tower and its slides is of secondary importance," McComber noted, "I do not mention it here, but will furnish figures upon application." A third proposal demanded even more courage from visitors. This inventor, who gave his initials as RTE, envisioned a tower 4,000 feet tall, from which he proposed to hang a 2,000-foot cable of best rubber. Attached at the bottom end of this cable would be a car seating 200 people. The car and its passengers would be shoved off a platform and fall without restraint to the end of the cable, where the car would snap back upward and continue bouncing until it came to a stop. The engineer urged that, as a precaution, the ground be covered with 8 feet of feather bedding. Everyone was thinking in terms of towers, but Burnham, for one, did not think a tower was the best approach. Eiffel had done it first and best. More than merely tall, his tower was grace frozen in iron, as much an evocation of the spirit of the age as Chartres had been in its time. To build a tower would be to follow Eiffel into territory he already had conquered for France. In August 1891, Eiffel himself telegraphed the directors to ask if he might submit a proposal for a tower. This was a surprise, and at first, a welcome one. Exposition President Baker immediately cabled Eiffel that the directors would be delighted to see whatever he proposed. "If the fair was to have a tower," Baker said in an interview, "Monsieur Eiffel is the man to build it. It would not be so much of an experiment if he should be in charge of its construction. He might be able to improve on his design for the Eiffel Tower in Paris, and I think it fair to assume that he would not construct one in any way inferior to that famous structure. To the engineers of America, however, this was a slap in the face. Over the next week and a half, telegrams shot from city to city, engineer to engineer, until the story became somewhat distorted. Suddenly it seemed as if an Eiffel Tower in Chicago was a certainty, that Eiffel himself was to do the out-Eiffeling. The engineers were outraged. A long letter of protest arrived at Burnham's office, signed by some of the nation's leading engineers. Acceptance of the distinguished gentleman's offer, they wrote, would be equivalent to a statement that the great body of civil engineers in this country, whose noble works attest their skill abroad as well as throughout the length and breadth of the land, lack the ability to cope with such a problem, and such action could have a tendency to rob them of their just claim to professional excellence. Burnham read this letter with approval. It pleased him to see America's civil engineers at last expressing passion for the fair, although in fact the directors had promised nothing to Eiffel. His formal proposal arrived a week later, envisioning a tower that was essentially a taller version of what he had built in Paris. The directors sent his proposal out for translation, reviewed it, then graciously turned it down. If there was to be a tower at the fair, it would be an American tower. For now, however, the drafting boards of America's engineers were dishearteningly barren. Saul Bloom, back in California, took his quest for a concession for his Algerian village to an influential San Franciscan, Mike DeYoung, publisher of the San Francisco Chronicle and one of the exposition's national commissioners. Bloom told him about the rights he had acquired in Paris and how the exposition had rebuffed his petition. DeYoung knew Bloom. As a teenager, Bloom had worked in DeYoung's Alcazar Theater and worked his way up to become its treasurer at age 19. In his spare time, Bloom had organized the ushers, checkers, and refreshment sellers into a more efficient, cohesive structure that greatly increased the theater's profits and his own salary. Next, he organized these functions at other theaters and received regular commissions from each. At the Alcazar, he inserted into scripts the names of popular products, bars, and restaurants, including the Cliff House, and for this received another stream of income. He also organized a cadre of professional applauders known as a claque to provide enthusiastic ovations, demand encores, and cry brava for any performer willing to pay. Most performers did pay, even the most famous diva of the time, Adelina Patti. One day Bloom saw an item in a theatrical publication about a novel Mexican band that he believed Americans would adore, and convinced their manager to let him bring the band north for a tour. Bloom's profit was $40,000. At the time, he was only 18. DeYoung told Bloom he would investigate the situation. 1 week later, he summoned Bloom back to his office. "How soon could you be ready to go to Chicago?" he asked. Bloom, startled, said, "In a couple of days, I guess." He assumed DeYoung had arranged a second opportunity for him to petition the fair's Ways and Means Committee. He was hesitant and told DeYoung he saw no value in making the journey until the exposition's directors had a better idea of the kinds of attractions they wanted. "The situation has advanced since our talk," DeYoung said. "All we need now is somebody to take charge." He gave Bloom a cable from the exposition company that empowered DeYoung to hire someone to manage the Midway Plaisance. "You've been elected," he said. "I can't do it," Bloom said. He did not want to leave San Francisco. "Even if I did, I've got too much at stake here to consider it." DeYoung watched him. "I don't want to hear another word from you till tomorrow," he said. In the meantime, DeYoung wanted Bloom to think about how much money he would have to be paid to overcome his reluctance. "When you come back, you can name your salary," he said. "I will either accept or reject it. There will be no argument. Is that agreeable?" Bloom did agree, but only because DeYoung's request gave him a graceful way of refusing the job. All he had to do, he figured, was name such an outrageous sum that DeYoung could not possibly accept it. And as I walked down the street, I decided what it would be. Burnham tried to anticipate every conceivable threat to the fair. Aware of Chicago's reputation for vice and violence, Burnham insisted on the creation of a large police force, the Columbian Guard, and placed it under the command of Colonel Edmund Rice, a man of great valor who had faced Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. Unlike conventional police departments, the Guard's mandate explicitly emphasized the novel idea of preventing crime, rather than merely arresting wrongdoers after the fact. Disease, too, posed dangers to the fair, Burnham knew. An outbreak of smallpox or cholera or any of the other lethal infections that roamed the city could irreparably taint the exposition and destroy any hopes the directors had of achieving the record attendance necessary to generate a profit. By now, the new science of bacteriology pioneered by Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur had convinced most public health officials that contaminated drinking water caused the spread of cholera and other bacterial diseases. Chicago's water teemed with bacteria, thanks mainly to the Chicago River. In a monumental spasm of civic engineering, the city in 1871 reversed the river's direction so that it no longer flowed into Lake Michigan, but ran instead into the Des Plaines River and ultimately into the Mississippi, the theory being that the immense flows of both rivers would dilute the sewage to harmless levels, a concept downriver towns like Joliet did not wholeheartedly embrace. To the engineer's surprise, however, prolonged rains routinely caused the Chicago River to regress and again pour dead cats and fecal matter into the lake, and in such volume that tendrils of black water reached all the way to the intake cribs of the city water system. Most Chicago residents had no choice but to drink the water. Burnham, however, believed from the start that the fair's workers and visitors needed a better, safer supply. In this, too, he was ahead of the age. On his orders, his sanitary engineer, William S. McHarg, built a water sterilization plant on the fairgrounds, which pumped lake water through a succession of large cedar tanks in which the water was aerated and boiled. McHarg's men set big casks of the sterilized water throughout the park and replenished the casks every day. Burnham planned to close the purification plant by opening day and give visitors a choice between two other supplies of safe water: lake water, purified with Pasteur filters and offered free of charge, or naturally pure water for a penny a cup, piped 100 miles from the coveted springs of Waukesha, Wisconsin. In November 1891, Burnham ordered McHarg to investigate five of Waukesha's springs to gauge their capacity and purity, but to do so quietly, suggesting he was aware that running a pipeline through the village's comely landscape might prove a sensitive issue. No one, however, could have imagined that in a few months McHarg's efforts to secure a supply of Waukesha's best would lead to an armed encounter in the middle of a fine Wisconsin night. What most worried Burnham was fire. The loss of the granite block with his and Root's headquarters remained a vivid, humiliating memory. A catastrophic fire in Jackson Park could destroy the fair. Yet within the park, fire was central to the construction process. Plasterers used small furnaces called salamanders to speed drying and curing. Tinners and electricians used fire pots for melting, bending, and fusing. Even the fire department used fire. Steam engines powered the pumps on the department's horse-drawn fire trucks. Burnham established defenses that by prevailing standards seemed elaborate, even excessive. He formed an exposition fire department and ordered the installation of hundreds of fire hydrants and telegraphic alarm boxes. He commissioned the construction of a fireboat, the Fire Queen, built specifically to negotiate the park's shallow canals and to pass under its many low bridges. Design specifications required that every building be surrounded with an underwater main and plumbed with interior standpipes. He also banned all smoking on the grounds, although here he made at least two exceptions. One for a contractor who pleaded that his crew of European artisans would quit if denied their cigars. The other for the big hearth in his shanty, around which he and his engineers, draftsmen, and visiting architects gathered each night for wine, talk, and cigars. With the onset of winter, Burnham ordered all hydrants packed in horse manure to prevent freezing. On the coldest days, the manure steamed as if the hydrants themselves were on fire. When Saul Bloom returned to the office of Mike DeYoung, he was confident DeYoung could not possibly accept his salary request, for he had decided to ask for the same salary as the President of the United States, $50,000. "The more I thought about it," Bloom recalled, "the more I enjoyed the prospect of telling Mike DeYoung that no less a sum could compensate me for my sacrifice in leaving San Francisco." DeYoung offered Bloom a seat. His expression was sober and expectant. Bloom said, "Much as I appreciate the compliment, I find that my interests lie right here in this city. As I look ahead, I can see myself..." DeYoung cut him off. Softly, he said, "Now, Saul, I thought you were going to tell me how much you wanted us to pay you." "I didn't want you to think I didn't appreciate." "You said that a minute ago," DeYoung said. "Now tell me how much money you want." This was not going quite the way Bloom had expected. With some trepidation, Bloom told him the number. $1,000 a week." DeYoung smiled. "Well, that's pretty good pay for a fellow of 21. But I have no doubt you'll earn it." In August, Burnham's chief structural engineer, Abraham Gottlieb, made a startling disclosure. He had failed to calculate wind loads for the fair's main buildings. Burnham ordered his key contractors, including Agnew and Company, erecting the manufacturer's building, to stop work immediately. For months, Burnham had been combating rumors that he had forced his men to work at too fast a pace, with the result that buildings were unsafe. In Europe, some press reports held that buildings had been condemned. Now, here was Gottlieb, conceding a potentially catastrophic error. Gottlieb protested that even without an explicit calculation of wind loads, the buildings were strong enough. "I could not, however, take this view," Burnham wrote in a letter to James Dredge, editor of the influential British magazine Engineering. Burnham ordered all designs strengthened to withstand the highest winds recorded over the previous 10 years. "This may be going to extremes," he told Dredge, "but to me it seems wise and prudent in view of the great interests involved." Gottlieb resigned. Burnham replaced him with Edward Shankland, an engineer from his own firm who possessed a national reputation as a designer of bridges. On November 24, 1891, Burnham wrote to James Dredge to report that once again he was under fire over the issue of structural integrity. "The criticism now," he wrote, "is that the structures are unnecessarily strong." Bloom arrived in Chicago and quickly discovered why so little had been accomplished at the Midway Plaisance, known officially as Department M. Until now, it had been under the control of Frederick Putnam, a Harvard professor of ethnology. He was a distinguished anthropologist, but putting him in charge of the Midway, Bloom said years later, was about as intelligent a decision as it would be today to make Albert Einstein manager of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Putnam would not have disagreed. He told a Harvard colleague he was anxious to get this whole Indian circus off my hands. Bloom took his concerns to Exposition President Baker, who turned him over to Burnham. "You are a very young man indeed to be in charge of the work entrusted to you," Burnham said. But Burnham himself had been young when John B. Sherman walked into his office and changed his life. "I want you to know that you have my full confidence," he said. You are in complete charge of the Midway. Go ahead with the work. You are responsible only to me. I will write orders to that effect. Good luck. By December 1891, the two buildings farthest along were the Mines and Mining Building and the Woman's Building. Construction on the Mining Building had gone smoothly, thanks to a winter that by Chicago standards had been mercifully benign. Construction of the Woman's Building, however, had become an ordeal, both for Burnham and its young architect, Sophia Hayden, mainly because of modifications demanded by Bertha Honoré Palmer, head of the fair's Board of Lady Managers, which governed all things at the fair having to do with women. As the wife of Potter Palmer, she was accustomed by wealth and absolute social dominance to having her own way, as she had made clear earlier in the year when she suppressed a revolt led by the board's executive secretary that had caused open warfare between factions of elegantly coiffed and dressed women. In the thick of it, one horrified lady manager had written to Mrs. Palmer, "I do hope that Congress will not become disgusted with our sex." Hayden came to Chicago to produce final drawings, then returned home, leaving their execution to Burnham. Construction began July 9th. Workers began applying the final coat of staff in October. Hayden returned in December to direct the decoration of the building's exterior, believing this to be her responsibility. She discovered that Bertha Palmer had other ideas. In September, without Hayden's knowledge, Palmer had invited women everywhere to donate architectural ornaments for the building, and in response had received a museum's worth of columns, panels, sculpted figures, window grills, doors, and other objects. Palmer believed the building could accommodate all the contributions, especially those sent by prominent women. Hayden, on the other hand, knew that such a hodgepodge of materials would result in an aesthetic abomination. When an influential Wisconsin woman named Flora Ginty sent an elaborately carved wooden door, Hayden turned it down. Ginty was hurt and angry. "When I think of the days I worked and the miles I traveled to achieve these things for the Woman's Building, my ire rises a little yet." Mrs. Palmer was in Europe at the time, but her private secretary, Laura Hayes, a gossip of virtuosic scope, made sure her employer learned all the details. Hayes also relayed to Palmer a few words of advice that she herself had given the architect. "I think it would be better to have the building look like a patchwork quilt than to refuse these things which the lady managers have been to such pains in soliciting." A patchwork quilt was not what Hayden had in mind. Despite Mrs. Palmer's blinding social glare, Hayden continued to decline donations. A battle followed, fought in true Gilded Age fashion with oblique snubs and poisonous courtesy. Mrs. Palmer pecked and pestered and catapulted icy smiles into Hayden's deepening gloom. Finally, Palmer assigned the decoration of the Woman's Building to someone else, a designer named Candace Wheeler. Hayden fought the arrangement in her quiet, stubborn way until she could take it no longer. She walked into Burnham's office, began to tell him her story, and promptly, literally, went mad. Tears, heaving sobs, cries of anguish, all of it. A severe breakdown, an acquaintance called it, with a violent attack of high nervous excitement of the brain. Burnham, stunned, summoned one of the exposition surgeons. Hayden was discreetly driven from the park in one of the fair's innovative English ambulances, with quiet rubber tires, and placed in a sanitarium for a period of enforced rest. She lapsed into melancholia, a sweet name for depression. At Jackson Park, aggravation was endemic. Simple matters, Burnham found, often became imbroglios. Even Olmsted had become an irritant. He was brilliant and charming, but once fixed on a thing, he was as unyielding as a slab of Joliet limestone. By the end of 1891, the question of what kind of boat to allow on the fair's waterways had come to obsess him, as if boats alone would determine the success of his quest for poetic mystery. In December 1891, Burnham received a proposal from a tugboat manufacturer arguing the case for steam launches at the exposition. Olmsted got wind of it from Harry Codman, who, in addition to being his chief operating man in Chicago, served as a kind of spy, keeping Olmsted abreast of all threats to Olmsted's vision. Codman sent Olmsted a copy of the letter, adding his own note that the tugboat maker seemed to enjoy Burnham's confidence. On December 23rd, Olmsted wrote to Burnham, "I suspect that even Codman is inclined to think that I make too much of a hobby of this boat question and give an amount of worry, if not thought, to it that would be better expended on other and more critical matters, and I fear that you may think me a crank upon it." He proceeded, however, to vent his obsession yet again. The tugmaker's letter, he complained, framed the boat question solely in terms of moving the greatest number of passengers between different points at the exposition as cheaply and quickly as possible. "You perfectly well know that the main object to be accomplished was nothing of this sort. I need not try to make a statement of what it was. You are as alive to it as I am. You know that it was a poetic object, and you know that if boats are to be introduced on these waters, it would be perfect nonsense to have them of a kind that would antagonize this poetic object." Mere transportation was never the goal, he fumed. The whole point of having boats was to enhance the landscape. Put in the waters unbecoming boats, and the effect would be utterly disgusting, destroying the value of what would otherwise be the most valuable original feature of this exposition. I say destroy deliberately. 1,000 times better to have no boats. Despite increasing committee interference and intensified conflict between Burnham and Director General Davis, and with the threat of labor strikes ever present, the main buildings rose. Workers laid foundations of immense timbers in crisscrossed layers in accord with Root's grillage principle, then used steam-powered derricks to raise the tall posts of iron and steel that formed each building's frame. They cocooned the frames in scaffolds of wood and faced each frame with hundreds of thousands of wood planks to create walls capable of accepting 2 thick layers of staff. As workers piled mountains of fresh lumber beside each building, jagged foothills of sawdust and scrap rose nearby. The air smelled of cut wood and Christmas. In December, the exposition experienced its first death. A man named Mueller at the mines building, dead of a fractured skull. 3 other deaths followed in short order. Jansen, fractured skull, electricity building. Allard, fractured skull, electricity building. Algier, stunned to oblivion by a new phenomenon, electric shock at the mines building. Dozens of lesser accidents occurred as well. Publicly, Burnham struck a pose of confidence and optimism. In a December 28, 1891 letter to the editor of the Chicago Herald, he wrote, "A few questions of design and plan are still undetermined, but there is nothing which is not well in hand, and I see no reason why we will not be able to complete our work in time for the ceremonies in October 1892, Dedication Day, and for the opening of the exposition, May 1st, 1893. In fact, the fair was clearly behind schedule, with worse delay forestalled only by the unexpectedly mild winter. The October dedication was to take place inside the manufacturer's building, yet as of January only the foundation of the building had been laid. For the fair to be even barely presentable in time for the ceremony, everything would have to go perfectly. The weather especially would have to cooperate. Meanwhile, banks and companies were failing across America. Strikes threatened everywhere, and cholera had begun a slow white trek across Europe, raising fears that soon the first plague ships would arrive in New York Harbor. As if anyone needed extra pressure, the New York Times warned, The failure of the fair, or anything short of a positive and pronounced success, would be a discredit to the whole country, and not to Chicago alone. Remains of the Day. In November 1891, Julia Connor announced to Holmes she was pregnant. Now, she told him, he had no choice but to marry her. Holmes reacted to her news with calm and warmth. He held her, stroked her hair, and with moist eyes assured her that she had nothing to worry about. Certainly he would marry her, as he long had promised. There was, however, a condition that he now felt obligated to impose. A child was out of the question. He would marry her only if she agreed to allow him to execute a simple abortion. He was a physician. He had done it before. He would use chloroform, and she would feel nothing and awaken to the prospect of a new life as Mrs. H. H. Holmes. Children would come later. Right now, there was far too much to do, especially given all the work that lay ahead to complete the hotel and furnish each of its rooms in time for the World's Fair. Holmes knew he possessed great power over Julia. First, there was the power that accrued to him naturally through his ability to bewitch men and women alike with false candor and warmth. Second, the power of social approbation that he now focused upon her. Though sexual liaisons were common, society tolerated them only as long as their details remained secret. Packing house princes ran off with parlor maids, and bank presidents seduced typewriters. When necessary, their attorneys arranged quiet solo voyages to Europe, to the surgical suites of discreet but capable doctors. A public pregnancy, without marriage, meant disgrace and destitution. Holmes possessed Julia now as fully as if she were an antebellum slave, and he reveled in his possession. The operation, he told Julia, would take place on Christmas Eve. Snow fell. Carolers moved among the mansions on Prairie Avenue, pausing now and then to enter the fine houses for hot mulled cider and cocoa. The air was scented with wood smoke and roasting duck. In Graceland Cemetery to the north, young couples raced their sleighs over the snow-heaped undulations, pulling their blankets especially tight as they passed the tall, gloomy guardian at the tomb of Dexter Graves. Eternal silence, a hooded figure with only darkness where the face should have been. To look into this emptiness, legend held, was to receive a glimpse into the underworld. At 701 63rd Street in Englewood, Julia Connor put her daughter to bed and did her best to smile and indulge the child's delighted anticipation of Christmas. Yes, St. Nicholas would come, and he would bring wonderful things. Holmes had promised a bounty of toys and sweets for Pearl, and for Julia, something truly grand, beyond anything she could have received from her poor, bland Ned. Outside, the snow muffled the concussion of passing horses. Trains bearing fangs of ice tore through the crossing at Wallace. Julia walked down the hall to an apartment occupied by Mr. and Mrs. John Crow. Julia and Mrs. Crow had become friends, and now Julia helped Mrs. Crow decorate a Christmas tree in the Crow's apartment, meant for Pearl as a Christmas morning surprise. Julia talked of all that she and Pearl would do the next day, and told Mrs. Crow that soon she would be going to Davenport, Iowa, to attend the wedding of an older sister. An old maid, Mrs. Crow said, who to everyone's surprise was about to marry a railroad man. Julia was awaiting the rail pass that the groom was supposed to have put in the mail. Julia left the apartment late that night in good spirits, Mrs. Crow later recalled. There was nothing about her conversation that would lead any of us to think she intended going away that night. Holmes offered Julia a cheerful Merry Christmas and gave her a hug, then took her hand and led her to a room on the second floor that he had readied for the operation. A table lay draped in white linen. His surgical kits stood open and gleaming, his instruments laid out in a sunflower of polished steel. Fearful things. Bone saws, abdomen retractor, trocar, and trepan. More instruments, certainly, than he really needed, and all positioned so that Julia could not help but see them and be sickened by their hard, eager gleam. He wore a white apron and had rolled back his cuffs. Possibly he wore his hat, a bowler. He had not washed his hands, nor did he wear a mask. There was no need. She reached for his hand. There would be no pain, he assured her. She would awaken as healthy as she was now, but without the encumbrance she bore within. He pulled the stopper from a dark amber bottle of liquid and immediately felt its silvery exhalation in his own nostrils. He poured the chloroform into a bunched cloth. She gripped his hand more tightly, which he found singularly arousing. He held the cloth over her nose and mouth. Her eyes fluttered and rolled upward. Then came the inevitable, reflexive disturbance of muscles, like a dream of running. She released his hand, cast it away with splayed fingers. Her feet trembled as if tapping to a wildly beating drum. His own excitement rose. She tried to pull his hand away, but he was prepared for this sudden surge of muscle stimulation that always preceded stupor, and with great force clamped the cloth to her face. She beat at his arms. Slowly the energy left her, and her hands began to move in slow arcs, soothing and sensuous, the wild drums silent. Ballet now. A pastoral exit. He kept one hand on the cloth and with the other dribbled more of the liquid between his fingers into its folds, delighting in the sensation of frost where the chloroform coated his fingers. One of her wrists sagged to the table, followed shortly by the other. Her eyelids stuttered, then closed. Holmes did not think her so clever as to feign coma, but he held tight just the same. After a few moments, he reached for her wrist and felt her pulse fade to nothing, like the rumble of a receding train. He removed the apron and rolled down his sleeves. The chloroform and his own intense arousal made him feel lightheaded. The sensation, as always, was pleasant and induced in him a warm languor, like the feeling he got after sitting too long in front of a hot stove. He stoppered the chloroform, found a fresh cloth, and walked down the hall to Pearl's room. It took only a moment to bunch the fresh cloth and douse it with chloroform. In the hall afterward, he examined his watch and saw that it was Christmas. The day meant nothing to Holmes. The Christmas mornings of his youth had been suffocated under an excess of piety, prayer, and silence, as if a giant wool blanket had settled over the house. On Christmas morning, the crows waited for Julia and Pearl in glad anticipation of watching the girls' eyes ignite upon spotting the lovely tree and the presents arrayed under its boughs. The apartment was warm, the air rouged with cinnamon and fir. An hour passed. The crows waited as long as they could, but at 10 o'clock they set out to catch a train for central Chicago, where they planned to visit friends. They left the apartment unlocked, with a cheerful note of welcome. The crows returned at 11 o'clock that night and found everything as they had left it, with no evidence that Julia and her daughter had come. The next morning they tried Julia's apartment, but no one answered. They asked neighbors inside and outside the building if any had seen Julia or Pearl, but none had. When Holmes next appeared, Mrs. Crow asked him where Julia might be. He explained that she and Pearl had gone to Davenport earlier than expected. Mrs. Crow heard nothing more from Julia. She and her neighbors thought the whole thing very odd. They all agreed that the last time anyone had seen Julia or Pearl was Christmas Eve. This was not precisely accurate. Others did see Julia again, although by then no one, Not even her own family back in Davenport, Iowa, could have been expected to recognize her. Just after Christmas, Holmes asked one of his associates, Charles Chappell, to come to his building. Holmes had learned that Chappell was an articulator, meaning he had mastered the art of stripping the flesh from human bodies and reassembling or articulating the bones to form complete skeletons for display in doctors' offices and laboratories. He had acquired the necessary techniques while articulating cadavers for medical students at Cook County Hospital. During his own medical education, Holmes had seen firsthand how desperate schools were to acquire corpses, whether freshly dead or skeletonized. The serious, systematic study of medicine was intensifying, and to scientists, the human body was like the polar ice cap, something to be studied and explored. Skeletons hung in doctors' offices where they served as visual encyclopedias. With demand outpacing supply, doctors established a custom of graciously and discreetly accepting any offered cadaver. They frowned on murder as a means of harvest. On the other hand, they made little effort to explore the provenance of any one body. Grave robbing became an industry, albeit a small one, requiring an exceptional degree of sang-froid. In periods of acute shortage, doctors themselves helped mine the newly departed. It was obvious to Holmes that even now, in the 1890s, demand remained high. Chicago's newspapers reported ghoulish tales of doctors raiding graveyards. After a foiled raid on a graveyard in New Albany, Indiana, on February 24, 1890, Dr. W. H. Wathen, head of the Kentucky Medical College, told a Tribune reporter, "The gentlemen were acting not for the Kentucky School of Medicine nor for themselves individually, but for the medical schools of Louisville, to which the human subject is as necessary as breath to life." Just 3 weeks later, the physicians of Louisville were at it again. They attempted to rob a grave at the State Asylum for the Insane in Anchorage, Kentucky, this time on behalf of the University of Louisville. "Yes, the party was sent out by us," a senior school official said. "We must have bodies, and if the state won't give them to us, we must steal them. The winter classes were large and used up so many subjects that there are none for the spring classes." He saw no need to apologize. "The asylum cemetery has been robbed for years," he said, "and I doubt if there is a corpse in it. I tell you, we must have bodies. You cannot make doctors without them, and the public must understand it. If we can't get them any other way, we will arm the students with Winchester rifles and send them to protect the body snatchers on their raids." Holmes had an eye for opportunity, and with demand for corpses so robust, opportunity now beckoned. He showed Charles Chappell into a second-floor room that contained a table, medical instruments, and bottles of solvents. These did not trouble Chappell, nor did the corpse on the table, for Chappell knew that Holmes was a physician. The body was clearly that of a woman, although of unusual height. He saw nothing to indicate her identity. The body, he said, looked like that of a jackrabbit, which had been skinned by splitting the skin down the face and rolling it back off the entire body. In some places, considerable of the flesh had been taken off with it. Holmes explained that he had been doing some dissection, but now had completed his research. He offered Chappell $36 to cleanse the bones and skull and return to him a fully articulated skeleton. Chappell agreed. Holmes and Chappell placed the body in a trunk lined with duck cloth. An express company delivered it to Chappell's house. Soon afterward, Chappell returned with the skeleton. Holmes thanked him, paid him, and promptly sold the skeleton to Hahnemann Medical College, the Chicago school, not the Philadelphia school of the same name, for many times the amount he had paid Chappell. In the second week of January, 1892, new tenants, the Doyle family, moved into Julia's quarters in Holmes's building. They found dishes on the table and Pearl's clothes hung over a chair. The place looked and felt as if the former occupants planned to return within minutes. The Doyles asked Holmes what had happened. With his voice striking the perfect sober note, Holmes apologized for the disarray and explained that Julia's sister had fallen gravely ill, and Julia and her daughter had left at once for the train station. There was no need to pack up their belongings, as Julia and Pearl were well provided for and would not be coming back. Later, Holmes offered a different story about Julia. I last saw her about January 1st, 1892, when a settlement of her rent was made. At this time, she had announced not only to me, but to her neighbors and friends, that she was going away. Although she had told everyone her destination was Iowa, in fact, Holmes said, she was going elsewhere to avoid the chance of her daughter being taken from her, giving the Iowa destination to mislead her husband. Holmes denied that he and Julia ever had engaged each other physically or that she had undergone a criminal operation, a then-current euphemism for abortion. That she is a woman of quick temper and perhaps not always of a good disposition may be true, but that any of her friends and relatives will believe her to be an amoral woman or one who would be a party to a criminal act, I do not think. A gauntlet dropped. 1892 broke cold, with 6 inches of snow on the ground and temperatures falling to 10 degrees below zero. Certainly not the coldest weather Chicago ever experienced, but cold enough to clot the valves of all 3 of the city water system's intake valves and temporarily halt the flow of Chicago's drinking water. Despite the weather, work at Jackson Park progressed. Workers erected a heated, movable shelter that allowed them to apply staff to the exterior of the mines and mining building no matter what the temperature. The woman's building was nearly done, all its scaffolding gone. The giant manufacturer's building had begun rising above its foundation. In all, the workforce in the park numbered 4,000. The ranks included a carpenter and furniture maker named Elias Disney, who in coming years would tell many stories about the construction of this magical realm beside the lake. His son Walt would take note. Beyond the exposition's 8-foot fence and its 2 tiers of barbed wire, there was tumult. Wage reductions and layoffs stoked unrest among workers nationwide. Unions gained strength. The Pinkerton National Detective Agency gained revenue. A rising union man named Samuel Gompers stopped by Burnham's office to discuss allegations that the exposition discriminated against union workers. Burnham ordered his construction superintendent, Dion Geraldine, to investigate. As labor strife increased and the economy faltered, the general level of violence rose. In taking stock of 1891, the Chicago Tribune reported that 5,906 people had been murdered in America, nearly 40% more than in 1890. The increase included Mr. and Mrs. Borden of Fall River, Massachusetts. The constant threat of strike and the onset of deep cold shaded the new year for Burnham, but what most concerned him was the fast-shrinking treasury of the exposition company. In advancing the work so quickly and on such a grand scale, Burnham's department had consumed far more money than anyone had anticipated. There was talk now among the directors of seeking a $10 million appropriation from Congress, but the only immediate solution was to reduce expenditures. On January 6th, Burnham commanded his department chiefs to take immediate, in some cases draconian, measures to cut costs. He ordered his chief draftsman in charge of exposition work underway in the attic of the rookery to fire at once any man who did inaccurate or slouchy work, or who failed to do more than his full duty. He wrote to Olmsted's landscape superintendent, Rudolf Ulrich, "It seems to me you can now cut your force down one half, and at the same time let very many expensive men go." Henceforth, Burnham ordered, all carpentry work was to be done only by men employed by the fair's contractors. To Geraldine, he wrote, "You will please dismiss every carpenter on your force." Until this point, Burnham had shown a level of compassion for his workers that was extraordinary for the time. He paid them even when illness or injury kept them out of work and established an exposition hospital which provided free medical care. He built quarters within the park where they received three large meals a day and slept in clean beds and well-heated rooms. A Princeton professor of political economy named Walter Wyckoff disguised himself as an unskilled laborer and spent a year traveling and working among the nation's growing army of unemployed men, including a stint at Jackson Park. Guarded by sentries and high barriers from unsought contact with all beyond, great gangs of us, healthy, robust men, live and labor in a marvelous artificial world, he wrote. No sight of misery disturbs us, nor of despairing poverty out in vain search for employment. We work our 8 hours a day in peaceful security and in absolute confidence of our pay. But now, even the fair was laying off men, and the timing was awful. With the advent of winter, the traditional building season had come to an end. Competition for the few jobs available had intensified as thousands of unemployed men from around the country, unhappily bearing the label hobo, derived possibly from the railroad cry, "Ho, boy," converged on Chicago in hopes of getting exposition work. The dismissed men, Burnham knew, faced homelessness and poverty. Their families confronted the real prospect of starvation. But the fair came first. The absence of an Eiffel Challenger continued to frustrate Burnham. Proposals got more and more bizarre. One visionary put forth a tower 500 feet taller than the Eiffel Tower, but made entirely of logs, with a cabin at the top for shelter and refreshment. The cabin would be a log cabin. If an engineer capable of besting Eiffel did not step forward soon, Burnham knew, there simply would not be enough time left to build anything worthy of the fair. Somehow he needed to rouse the engineers of America. The opportunity came with an invitation to give a talk to the Saturday Afternoon Club, a group of engineers who had begun meeting on Saturdays at a downtown restaurant to discuss the construction challenges of the fair. There was the usual meal in multiple courses, with wine, cigars, coffee, and cognac. At one table sat a 33-year-old engineer from Pittsburgh, ran a steel inspection with company, bought branch offices in New York and Chicago, and which already possessed the exposition contract to inspect steel used in the fair's buildings. He had an angular face, black hair, black mustache, and dark eyes, the kind of looks soon to be coveted by an industry Thomas Edison was just then bringing to life. He was eminently engaging and social, and he had a keen sense of humor, his partners wrote. In all gatherings, he at once became the center of attraction, having a ready command of language and a constant fund of amusing anecdotes and experiences. Like the other members of the Saturday Afternoon Club, he expected to hear Burnham discuss the challenges of building an entire city on such a short schedule. But Burnham surprised him. After asserting that the architects of America had covered themselves with glory through their exposition designs, Burnham rebuked the nation's civil engineers for failing to rise to the same level of brilliance. The engineers, Burnham charged, had contributed little or nothing either in the way of originating novel features or of showing the possibilities of modern engineering practice in America. A tremor of displeasure rolled through the room. "Some distinctive feature is needed," Burnham continued, "something to take the relative position in the world's Columbian Exposition that was filled by the Eiffel Tower at the Paris Exposition." "But not a tower," he said. "Towers were not original. Eiffel had built a tower already. Mere bigness wasn't enough either. Something novel, original, daring, and unique must be designed and built if American engineers are to retain their prestige and standing." Some of the engineers took offense. Others acknowledged that Burnham had a point. The engineer from Pittsburgh felt himself cut to the quick by the truth of these remarks. As he sat there among his peers, an idea came to him like an inspiration. It arrived not as some half-formed impulse, he said, but rich in detail. He could see it and touch it, hear it as it moved through the sky. There was not much time left, but if he acted quickly to produce drawings and managed to convince the Fair's Ways and Means Committee of the idea's feasibility, he believed the exposition could indeed out Eiffel Eiffel. And if what happened to Eiffel happened to him, his fortune would be assured. It must have been refreshing for Burnham to stand before the Saturday Afternoon Club and openly chide its members for their failure, because most of his other encounters over exposition business invariably became exercises in self-restraint, especially when he went before the Fair's many and still multiplying committees. This constant Victorian minuet of false grace consumed time. He needed more power. Not for his own ego, but for the sake of the exposition. Unless the pace of decision-making accelerated, he knew, the Fair would fall irreparably behind schedule. Yet, if anything, the barriers to efficiency were increasing in size and number. The exposition company's shrinking war chest had driven its relationship with the National Commission to a new low, with Director General Davis arguing that any new federal money should be controlled by his commission. The commission seemed to form new departments every day, each with a paid chief. Davis named a superintendent of sheep for a salary equivalent to $60,000 a year, and each claiming some piece of jurisdiction that Burnham thought belonged to him. Soon the struggle for control distilled to a personal conflict between Burnham and Davis. Its primary battlefield, a disagreement over who should control the artistic design of exhibits and interiors. Burnham thought it obvious that the territory belonged to him. Davis believed otherwise. At first, Burnham tried the oblique approach. "We are now organizing a special interior decorative and architectural force to handle this part," he wrote to Davis, "and I have the honor to offer the services of my department to yours in such manners. I feel a delicacy in having my men suggest to yours artistic arrangements, forms, and decorations of exhibits without your full approval, which I hereby respectfully ask." But Davis told a reporter, "I think it is pretty well understood by this time that no one but the Director General and his agents have anything to do with exhibits." The conflict simmered. On March 14th, Burnham joined Davis for dinner with Japan's delegate to the fair at the Chicago Club. Afterward, Davis and Burnham remained at the club, arguing quietly until 5 o'clock the next morning. "The time was well spent," he wrote to Margaret, who was then out of town, "and we have come to a better feeling so that the path will be much smoother from this time forward." An uncharacteristic weariness crept into his letter. He told Margaret he planned to end work early that night and go to Evanston. "And sleep in your dear bed, my love, and I shall dream of you. What a rush this life is! Where do the years go to?" There were moments of grace. Burnham looked forward to evenings on the grounds when his lieutenants and visiting architects would gather for dinner at the shanty and converse into the night in front of Burnham's immense fireplace. Burnham treasured the camaraderie and the stories. Olmsted recounted the endless trials of protecting Central Park from ill-thought modifications. Colonel Edmund Rice, chief of the exposition's Columbian Guard, described what it was like to stand in a shaded wood at Gettysburg as Pickett launched his men across the intervening field. Late in March 1892, Burnham invited his sons to join him at the shanty for one of their periodic overnight stays. They failed to arrive at the scheduled time. At first, everyone attributed their absence to a routine railroad delay, but as the hours passed, Burnham's anxiety grew. He knew as well as anyone that train wrecks in Chicago were nearly a daily occurrence. Darkness began to fall, but at last the boys arrived. Their train had been held up by a broken bridge on the Milwaukee and St. Paul line. They reached the shanty, Burnham wrote to Margaret, just in time to hear Colonel Rice tell some yarns about the war and life in the plains among the scouts and Indians. As Burnham wrote this letter, his sons were near at hand. They are very happy to be here and are now looking at the large photographic album with Mr. Geraldine. The album was a collection of construction photographs taken by Charles Dudley Arnold, a photographer from Buffalo, New York, whom Burnham had hired as the fair's official photographer. Arnold also was present, and soon the children were to join him in a sketching session. Burnham closed, "We are all well and satisfied with the amount and variety of work our good fortune has given us to do." Such peaceful intervals never lasted long. The conflict between Burnham and Davis again flared to life. The directors of the Exposition Company did decide to seek a direct appropriation from Congress, but their request triggered a congressional investigation of the fair's expenditures. Burnham and President Baker expected a general review, but instead found themselves grilled about the most mundane expenses. For example, when Baker listed the total spent on carriage rental, the subcommittee demanded the names of the people who rode in the carriages. At one session in Chicago, the committee asked Davis to estimate the final cost of the exposition. Without consulting Burnham, Davis gave an estimate 10% below the amount Burnham had calculated for President Baker, which Baker had then included in his own statement to investigators. Davis's testimony carried with it the unstated accusation that Burnham and Baker had inflated the amount of money needed to complete the fair. Burnham leapt to his feet. The subcommittee chairman ordered him to sit. He remained standing. He was angry, barely able to keep himself composed. "Mr. Davis has not been to see me or any of my people," he said, "and any figures he has given, he has jumped at. He knows nothing about the matter." His outburst offended the subcommittee chairman. "I object to any such remarks addressed to a witness before this committee," the chairman said, "and I will ask that Mr. Burnham withdraw his remark." At first, Burnham refused. Then, reluctantly, he agreed to withdraw the part about Davis knowing nothing. But only that part. He did not apologize. The committee left for Washington to study the evidence and report on whether an appropriation was warranted. "The congressmen," Burnham wrote, "are dazed with the size and scope of this enterprise. We gave them each a huge pile of data to digest, and I think their report will be funny, because I know that months would not be enough time for me to work out a report, even with my knowledge." On paper, at least, the fair's midway placence began to take shape. Professor Putnam had believed the midway ought first and foremost to provide an education about alien cultures. Saul Bloom felt no such duty. The midway was to be fun, a great pleasure garden stretching for more than a mile from Jackson Park all the way to the border of Washington Park. It would thrill, titillate, and, if all went well, perhaps even shock. He considered his great strength to be spectacular advertising. He placed notices in publications around the world to make it known that the midway was to be an exotic realm of unusual sights, sounds, and scents. There would be authentic villages from far-off lands inhabited by authentic villagers, even pygmies if Lieutenant Shufeld succeeded. Bloom recognized also that as Tsar of the Midway, he no longer had to worry about seeking a concession for his Algerian village. He could approve the village himself. He produced a contract and sent it off to Paris. Bloom's knack for promotion caught the attention of other fair officials, who came to him for help in raising the exposition's overall profile. At one point, he was called upon to help make reporters understand how truly immense the manufacturer's building would be. So far, the exposition's publicity office had given the press a detailed list of monumental but dreary statistics. I could tell they weren't in the least interested in the number of acres or tons of steel, Bloom wrote. So I said, "Look at it this way. It's going to be big enough to hold the entire standing army of Russia. Bloom had no idea whether Russia even had a standing army, let alone how many soldiers it might include and how many square feet they would cover. Nonetheless, the fact became gospel throughout America. Readers of Rand McNally's exposition guidebooks eventually found themselves thrilling to the vision of millions of fur-hatted men squeezed onto the building's 32-acre floor. Bloom felt no remorse. The Angel from Dwight. In the spring of 1892, Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pititzel, found himself in the city of Dwight, Illinois, about 75 miles southwest of Chicago, taking the famous Keeley cure for alcoholism. Patients stayed in the three-story Livingston Hotel, a red brick building of simple, appealing design, with arched windows and a veranda along the full length of its facade, a fine place to rest between injections of Dr. Leslie Enrot Keeley's Gold Cure. Gold was the most famous ingredient in a red, white, and blue solution nicknamed the barber pole, that employees of the Keeley Institute injected into patients' arms 3 times a day. The needle, one of large 19th-century bore, like having a garden hose shoved into a bicep, invariably deposited a yellow aureole on the skin surrounding the injection site, a badge for some, an unsightly blemish for others. The rest of the formula was kept secret, but as best doctors and chemists could tell, the solution included substances that imparted a pleasant state of euphoria and sedation, trimmed with amnesia. An effect the Chicago Post Office found problematic, for each year it wound up holding hundreds of letters sent from Dwight that lacked important elements of their destination addresses. The senders simply forgot that things like names and street numbers were necessary for the successful delivery of mail. Pititzel had long been a heavy drinker, but his drinking must have become debilitating, for it was Holmes who sent him to Keeley and paid for his treatment. He explained it to Pititzel as a gesture born of kindness, a return for Pititzel's loyalty. As always, he had other motives. He recognized that Pititzel's drinking impaired his usefulness and threatened to disrupt schemes already in play. Holmes later said of Pititzel, "He was too valuable a man, even with his failings taken into consideration, for me to dispense with." It's likely Holmes also wanted Pititzel to gather whatever intelligence he could about the cure and its labeling, so that he could mimic the product and sell it through his own mail-order drug company. Later, indeed, Holmes would establish his own curative spa on the second floor of his Englewood building and call it the Silver Ash Institute. The Keeley Cure was amazingly popular. Thousands of people came to Dwight to shed their intemperate ways. Many thousands more bought Dr. Keeley's oral version of the cure, which he marketed in bottles so distinctive that he urged purchasers to destroy the empties, to keep unscrupulous companies from filling them with their own concoctions. Every day, Pititzel joined 3 dozen other men in the daily ritual of passing through the line to receive his injections. Women received theirs in their own rooms and were kept separated from the men to protect their reputations. In Chicago, hostesses always knew when guests had taken the cure, because upon being offered a drink, the guests invariably answered, "No, thank you. I've been to Dwight." Pititzel returned to Englewood in April. The psychotropic powers of Keeley's injections may account for the story Pititzel now told Holmes, of how, at Keeley, he had met a young woman of great beauty. To hear him tell it, preternatural beauty, named Emmeline Sigrand. She was blonde, 24 years old, and since 1891 had worked as a stenographer in Dr. Keeley's office. Pititzel's almost hallucinatory description must have tantalized Holmes, for he wrote to Sigrand and offered her a job as his personal secretary at twice the salary she was making in Keeley. A flattering offer, as a member of the Sigrand family later described it. Emmeline accepted without hesitation. The Institute had a certain cachet, but the village of Dwight was no Chicago. To be able to earn twice her salary and live in that city of legendary glamour and excitement with the World's Fair set to open in a year, made the offer irresistible. She left Keeley in May, bringing along her $800 in savings. Upon arriving in Englewood, she rented rooms in a boarding house near Holmes's building. Pitatzel had exaggerated Emmeline's beauty, Holmes saw, but not by much. She was indeed lovely, with luminous blonde hair. Immediately Holmes deployed his tools of seduction, his soothing voice and touch and frank blue gaze. He bought her flowers and took her to the Timmerman Opera House down the block. He gave her a bicycle. They spent evenings riding together on the smooth macadam of Yale and Harvard streets, the picture of a happy young couple blessed with looks and money. White piqué hats with black watered ribbon bands and a couple of knife feathers set at the side are the latest novelty for women cyclists, the Tribune's society column observed. As Emmeline became more accustomed to her wheel, a term everyone still used even though the old and deadly huge-wheeled bicycles of the past had become thoroughly obsolete, she and Holmes took longer and longer rides, and often rode down the willowed midway to Jackson Park to watch the construction of the World's Fair, where inevitably they found themselves among thousands of other people, many of them also bicyclists. On a few Sundays, Emmeline and Holmes rode into the park itself, where they saw that construction was still in its early phase, a surprise given the rapid onset of the fair's two most important deadlines, Dedication Day and Opening Day. Much of the park was still barren land, and the biggest building, the Manufactures and Liberal Arts, was barely underway. A few buildings had advanced at a far greater pace and appeared to be more or less complete, in particular the Mines and Mining Building and the Woman's Building. There were so many distinguished-looking men in the park these days. Statesmen, princes, architects, and the city's industrial barons. Society matrons came as well to attend meetings of the Board of Lady Managers. Mrs. Palmer's great black carriage often came roaring through the fair's gate, as did the carriage of her social opposite, Carrie Watson, the Madam, her coach distinctive for its gleaming white enamel and yellow wheels, and its black driver in scarlet silk. Emmeline found that riding her bicycle was best in the days after a good downpour. Otherwise, the dust billowed like sand over Khartoum and sifted deep into her scalp, where even a good brushing failed to dislodge it. One afternoon, as Emmeline sat before her typewriter in Holmes's office, a man entered, looking for Holmes. He was tall with a clean jaw and modest mustache, and wore a cheap suit. In his 30s. Good-looking, in a way, but at the same time self-effacing and plain, though at the moment he appeared to be angry. He introduced himself as Ned Connor and said he once had run the jewelry counter in the pharmacy downstairs. He had come to discuss a problem with a mortgage. She knew the name, had heard it somewhere or seen it in Holmes's papers. She smiled and told Ned that Holmes was out of the building. She had no idea when he would return. Could she help? Ned's anger cooled. He and Emmeline got to talking about Holmes, as Ned later recalled. Ned watched her. She was young and pretty, a handsome blonde, as he later described her. She wore a white shirtwaist and black skirt that accentuated her trim figure, and was seated beside a window, her hair candescent with sunlight. She sat before a black Remington, new and doubtless never paid for. From his own hard experience and from the look of adoration that entered Emmeline's eyes when she spoke of Holmes, Ned guessed her relationship involved a good deal more than typewriting. Later, he recalled, "I told her I thought he was a bad lot and that she had better have little to do with him and get away from him as soon as possible." For the time being, at least, she ignored his advice. On May 1st, 1892, a doctor named M.B. Lawrence and his wife moved into a five-room apartment in Holmes's building, where they often encountered Emmeline, although Emmeline herself did not yet live in the building. She still occupied rooms in a nearby boarding house. She was one of the prettiest and most pleasant young women I ever met, said Dr. Lawrence, and my wife and I learned to think a great deal of her. We saw her every day, and she often came in for a few minutes' chat with Mrs. Lawrence. The Lawrences often saw Emmeline in Holmes's company. It was not long, Dr. Lawrence said, before I became aware that the relations between Miss Sigrand and Mr. Holmes were not strictly those of an employer and employee, but we felt that she was to be more pitied than blamed. Emmeline was infatuated with Holmes. She loved him for his warmth, his caresses, his imperturbable calm, and his glamour. Never had she met a man quite like him. He was even the son of an English lord, a fact he had confided in strictest secrecy. She was to tell no one, which dampened the fun quite a bit, but added to the mystery. She did reveal the secret to friends, of course, but only after first securing their oaths that they absolutely would tell no one else. To Emmeline, Holmes's claim of lordly heritage had credibility. The name Holmes clearly was English. To know that, all one had to do was read the immensely popular stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And an English heritage would explain his extraordinary charm and smooth manner, so unusual in brutish, clangorous Chicago. Emmeline was a warm and outgoing woman. She wrote often to her family in Lafayette, Indiana, and to the friends she had made in Dwight. She acquired friends easily. She still dined at regular intervals with the woman who ran the first boarding house in which she had stayed after her arrival in Chicago, and considered the woman an intimate friend. In October, two of her second cousins, Dr. and Mrs. B.J. Sigrand, paid her a visit. Dr. Sigrand, a dentist with an office at North and Milwaukee Avenues on Chicago's north side, had contacted Emmeline because he was working on a history of the Sigrand family. They had not previously met. I was charmed by her pleasing manners and keen wit, Dr. Sigrand said. She was a splendid woman physically, being tall, well-formed, and with a wealth of flaxen hair. Dr. Sigrand and his wife did not encounter Holmes on this visit, and in fact they never did meet him face to face. But they heard glowing stories from Emmeline about his charm, generosity, and business prowess. Emmeline took her cousins on a tour of Holmes's building and told them of his effort to transform it into a hotel for exposition guests. She explained, too, how the elevated railroad being erected over 63rd Street would carry guests directly to Jackson Park. No one doubted that by the summer of 1893, armies of visitors would be advancing on Englewood. To Emmeline, success seemed inevitable. Emmeline's enthusiasm was part of her charm. She was headlong in love with her young physician and thus in love with all that he did. But Dr. Sigrand did not share her glowing assessment of the building and its prospects. To him, the building was gloomy and imposing, out of spirit with its surrounding structures. Every other building of substance in Englewood seemed to be charged with the energy of anticipation, not just of the World's Fair, but of a grand future expanding far beyond the fair's end. Within just a couple of blocks of 63rd rose huge, elaborate houses of many colors and textures, and down the street stood the Timmerman Opera House and the adjacent New Julian Hotel, whose owners clearly had spent heavily on fine materials and expert craftsmen. In contrast, Holmes's building was dead space, like the corner of a room where the gaslight could not reach. Clearly, Holmes had not consulted an architect, at least not a competent one. The building's corridors were dark and pocked with too many doors. The lumber was low grade, the carpentry slipshod. Passages veered at odd angles. Still, Emmeline seemed entranced. Dr. Sigrand would have been a cold man indeed to have dashed that sweet, naive adoration. Later, no doubt, he wished he had been more candid and had listened more closely to the whisper in his head about the wrongness of that building and the discontinuity between its true appearance and Emmeline's perception of its appearance. But again, Emmeline was in love. It was not his place to wound her. She was young and enraptured, her joy infectious, especially to Dr. Sigrend, the dentist, who saw so little joy from day to day as he reduced grown men of proven courage to tears. Soon after the Sigrens' visit, Holmes asked Emmeline to marry him, and she accepted. He promised her a honeymoon in Europe, during which, of course, they would pay a visit to his father, the Lord. Monstrosity. Olmsted's teeth hurt. His ears roared, and he could not sleep. Yet throughout the first months of 1892, he kept up a pace that would have been punishing for a man one-third his age. He traveled to Chicago, Asheville, Knoxville, Louisville, and Rochester, each overnight leg compounding his distress. In Chicago, despite the tireless efforts of his young lieutenant, Harry Codman, the work was far behind schedule, the task ahead growing more enormous by the day. The first major deadline, the dedication set for October 21st, 1892, seemed impossibly near, and would have seemed even more so had not fair officials changed the original date, October 12th, to allow New York City to hold its own Columbus celebration. Given the calumny New York previously had shoveled on Chicago, the postponement was an act of surprising grace. Construction delays elsewhere on the grounds were especially frustrating for Olmsted. When contractors fell behind, his own work fell behind. His completed work also suffered. Workmen trampled his plantings and destroyed his roads. The government building was a case in point. All over its surroundings, reported Rudolf Ulrich, his landscape superintendent, material of any kind and all descriptions was piled up and scattered in such profusion that only repeated and persistent pressure brought to bear upon the officials in charge could gain any headway in beginning the work, and even then, improvements being well underway, no regard was paid to them. What had been accomplished one day would be spoiled the next. The delays and damage angered Olmsted, but other matters distressed him even more. Unbelievably, despite Olmsted's hectoring, Burnham still seemed to consider steam-powered launches an acceptable choice for the exposition's boat service. And no one seemed to share his conviction that the wooded island must remain free of all structures. The island had come under repeated assault, prompting a resurfacing of Olmsted's old anger about the compulsion of clients to tinker with his landscapes. Everyone wanted space on the island. First, it was Theodore Thomas, conductor of Chicago's symphony, who saw the island as the ideal site, the only site, for a music hall worthy of the fair. Olmsted would not allow it. Next came Theodore Roosevelt, head of the U.S. Civil Service Commission, and a human gunboat. The island, he insisted, was perfect for the hunting camp exhibit of his Boone and Crockett Club. Not surprisingly, given Roosevelt's power in Washington, the politicians of the fair's National Commission strongly endorsed his plan. Burnham, partly to keep the peace, also urged Olmsted to accept it. "Would you object to its being placed on the north end of the island, snuggled in among the trees, purely as an exhibit, provided it shall be so concealed as to only be noticed casually by those on the island, and not at all from the shore?" Olmsted did object. He agreed to let Roosevelt place his camp on a lesser island, but would not allow any buildings, only a few tents, some horses, campfire, etc. Later, he permitted the installation of a small hunter's cabin. Next came the U.S. government, seeking to place an Indian exhibit on the island. And after this, Professor Putnam, the fair's chief of ethnology, who saw the island as the ideal site for several exotic villages. The government of Japan also wanted the island. They propose an outdoor exhibit of their temples, and, as has been usual, they desire space on the wooded island, Burnham wrote in February 1892. To Burnham, it now seemed inevitable that something would occupy the island. The setting was just too appealing. Burnham urged Olmsted to accept Japan's proposal. It seems beyond any question to be the thing fitting to the locality, and I cannot see that it will in any manner detract essentially from the features which you care for. They propose to do the most exquisitely beautiful things, and desire to leave the buildings as a gift to the city of Chicago after the close of the fair. Fearing much worse, Olmsted agreed. It did not help his mood any that as he battled to protect the island, he learned of another attack on his beloved Central Park. At the instigation of a small group of wealthy New Yorkers, the state legislature had quietly passed a law authorizing the construction of a speedway on the west side of the park so that the rich could race their carriages. The public responded with outrage. Olmsted weighed in with a letter describing the proposed road as unreasonable, unjust, and immoral. The legislature backed off. His insomnia and pain, the crushing workload, his mounting frustration, all tore at his spirit until by the end of March he felt himself on the verge of physical and emotional collapse. The intermittent depression that had shadowed him throughout his adult life was about to envelop him once again. "When Olmsted is blue," a friend once wrote, "the logic of his despondency is crushing and terrible." Olmsted, however, believed all he needed was a good rest. In keeping with the therapeutic mores of the age, he decided to do his convalescing in Europe, where the scenery also would provide an opportunity to enrich his visual vocabulary. He planned forays to public gardens and parks and the grounds of the old Paris Exposition. He put his eldest son, John, in charge of the Brookline office and left Harry Codman in Chicago to guide the work on the World's Fair. At the last minute, he decided to bring along two of his children, Marion and Rick, and another young man, Phil Codman, who was Harry's younger brother. For Marion and the boys, it promised to be a dream journey. For Olmsted, it became something rather more dark. They sailed on Saturday, April 2nd, 1892, and arrived in Liverpool under a barrage of hail and snow. In Chicago, Saul Bloom received a cable from France that startled him. He read it a couple of times to make sure it said what he thought it said. His Algerians, scores of them, along with all their animals and material possessions, were already at sea, sailing for America and the fair, 1 year early. They had picked the right month, Bloom said, but the wrong year. Olmsted found the English countryside charming, the weather bleak and morbid. After a brief stay at the home of relatives in Chislehurst, he and the boys left for Paris. Daughter Marion stayed behind. In Paris, Olmsted went to the old exposition grounds. The gardens were sparse, suppressed by a long winter, and the buildings had not weathered well, but enough of the fair remained to give him a tolerable idea of what the exposition once had been. Clearly the site was still popular. During one Sunday visit, Olmsted and the boys found four bands playing, refreshment stands open, and a few thousand people roaming the paths. A long line had formed at the base of the Eiffel Tower. With the Chicago Fair always in mind, Olmsted examined every detail. The lawns were rather poor, the gravel walks not pleasant to the eye nor to the foot. He found the Paris Fair's extensive use of formal flower beds objectionable. "It seemed to me," he wrote in a letter to John in Brookline, "that at the least it must have been extremely disquieting, gaudy and childish, if not savage and an injury to the exposition, through its disturbance of dignity and injury to breadth, unity, and composure." He reiterated his insistence that in Chicago, simplicity and reserve will be practiced and petty effects and frippery avoided. The visit rekindled his concern that in the quest to surpass the Paris Exposition, Burnham and his architects had lost sight of what a World's Fair ought to be. The Paris buildings, Olmsted wrote, have much more color and much more ornament in color, but much less in molding and sculpture than I had supposed. They show, I think, more fitness for their purposes, seem more designed for the occasion, and to be less like grand permanent architectural monuments than ours are to be. I question if ours are not at fault in this respect, and if they are not going to look too assuming of architectural stateliness, and to be over-bonded with sculptural and other efforts for grandeur and grandiloquent pomp. Olmsted liked traveling with his youthful entourage. In a letter to his wife in Brookline, he wrote, I am having a great deal of enjoyment, and I hope laying in a good stock of better health. Soon after the party returned to Chislehurst, however, Olmsted's health degraded, and insomnia again shattered his nights. He wrote to Harry Codman, who was himself ill with a strange abdominal illness, I can only conclude now that I am older and more used up than I had supposed. A doctor, Henry Rayner, paid a social visit to Chislehurst to meet Olmsted. He happened to be a specialist in treating nervous disorders, and was so appalled by Olmsted's appearance that he offered to take him to his own house in Hampstead Heath outside London and care for him personally. Olmsted accepted. Despite Rayner's close attention, Olmsted's condition did not improve. His stay at Hampstead Heath became wearisome. You know that I am practically in prison here, he wrote to Harry Codman on June 16, 1892. Every day I look for decided improvement, and thus far every day I am disappointed. Dr. Rayner, too, was perplexed, according to Olmsted. He says, with confidence, after repeated examinations of all my anatomy, that I have no organic trouble, and that I may reasonably expect, under favorable circumstances, to keep at work for several years to come. He regards my present trouble as a variation in form of the troubles which led me to come abroad. Most days Olmsted was driven by carriage through the countryside, every day more or less on a different road, to view gardens, churchyards, private parks, and the natural landscape. Nearly every ornamental flower bed offended him. He dismissed them as childish, vulgar, flaunting, or impertinent, out of place and discordant. The countryside itself, however, charmed him. There is nothing in America to be compared with the pastoral or with the picturesque beauty that is common property in England. I cannot go out without being delighted. The view before me as I write, veiled by the rain, is just enchanting. The loveliest scenes he found were comprised of the simplest, most natural juxtapositions of native plants. The finest combination is one of gorse, sweetbriar, brambles, hawthorn, and ivy. Even when there is no bloom, this is charming. And these things can be had by the 100,000 at very low prices. At times the scenes he saw challenged his vision of Jackson Park. At other times they affirmed it. Everywhere the best ornamental grounds that we see are those in which vines and creepers are outwitting the gardener. We can't have little vines and weeds enough. He knew there was too little time to let nature alone produce such effects. Let us, as much as possible, train out creepers and branches of trees upon bridges, pulling down and nailing the branches, aiming to obtain shade and reflection of foliage, and broken obscuration of water. Above all, his sorties reinforced his belief that the wooded island, despite the Japanese temple, should be made as wild as possible. I think more than ever of the value of the island, he wrote to Harry Codman, and of the importance of using all possible original means of securing impervious screening, dense, massive piles of foliage on its borders, with abundant variety of small detail in abject subordination to general effect. There cannot be enough of bulrush, adlumia, Madeira vine, catbriar, virgin's bower, brambles, sweet peas, jimson weed, milkweed, the smaller western sunflowers and morning glories. But he also recognized that the wildness he sought would have to be tempered with excellent groundskeeping. He worried that Chicago would not be up to the task. The standard of an English laborer, hack driver, or cad in respect to neatness, smugness, and elegance of gardens and grounds and paths and ways is infinitely higher than that of a Chicago merchant prince or virtuoso, he wrote to Codman, and we shall be disgraced if we fail to work up to a far higher level than our masters will be prepared to think suitable. Overall, Olmsted remained confident that his exposition landscape would succeed. A new worry troubled him, however. The only cloud I see over the exposition now is the cholera, he wrote in a letter to his Brookline office. The accounts from Russia and from Paris this morning are alarming. As Saul Bloom's Algerians neared New York Harbor, workers assigned to the Midway erected temporary buildings to house them. Bloom went to New York to meet the ship and reserved 2 train cars to bring the villagers and their cargo back to Chicago. As the Algerians left the ship, they began moving in all directions at once. I could see them getting lost, being run over, and landing in jail, Bloom said. No one seemed to be in charge. Bloom raced up to them, shouting commands in French and English. A giant black-complected man walked up to Bloom and, in perfect House of Lords English, said, I suggest you be more civil, otherwise I may lose my temper and throw you into the water. The man identified himself as Archie, and as the two settled into a more peaceful conversation, he revealed to Bloom that he had spent a decade in London serving as a rich man's bodyguard. At present, he said, I am responsible for conveying my associates to a place called Chicago. I understand it is somewhere in the hinterland. Bloom handed him a cigar and proposed that he become his bodyguard and assistant. Your offer, Archie said, is quite satisfactory. Both men lit up and puffed smoke into the fragrant murk above New York Harbor. Bloom wanted to thrill America, but even he did not appreciate the power the Algerians possessed to succeed at the task. Bloom put the members to work. Archie became a powerful and vaguely threatening presence in his office. Several Algerian women also worked there, clad in customary dress and speaking excellent English, while evoking a world of cinnamon and heat that greatly enhanced Bloom's stature as a promotional prodigy. Burnham fought to boost the rate of construction, especially of the manufacturer's building, which had to be completed by dedication day. In March, with just half a year remaining until the dedication, he invoked the Tsar clause of his construction contracts. He ordered the builder of the electricity building to double his workforce and to put the men to work at night under electric lights. He threatened the manufacturer's contractor with the same fate if he did not increase the pace of his work. Burnham had all but given up hope of surpassing the Eiffel Tower. Most recently, he had turned down another outlandish idea, this from an earnest young Pittsburgh engineer who had attended his lecture to the Saturday Afternoon Club. The man was credible enough. His company held the contract for inspecting all the steel used in the fair's structures, but the thing he proposed to build just did not seem feasible. Too fragile, Burnham told him. The public, he said, would be afraid. A hostile spring further hampered the fair's progress. On Tuesday, April 5th, 1892, at 6:50 a.m., a sudden windstorm demolished the fair's just-finished pumping station and tore down 65 feet of the Illinois State Building. 3 weeks later, another storm destroyed 800 feet of the south wall of the manufacturer's building. The wind, the Tribune observed, seems to have a grudge against the World's Fair grounds. To find ways to accelerate the work, Burnham called the Eastern Architects to Chicago. One looming problem was how to color the exteriors of the main buildings, especially the staff-coated palisades of the manufacturer's building. During the meeting, an idea arose that promised a dramatic acceleration of the work. No one could have foretold how this one decision would forever fix the fair in the world's imagination as a thing of otherworldly beauty. By all rights, the arena of exterior decoration belonged to William Prettyman, the fair's official director of color. Burnham admitted later that he had hired Prettyman for the job largely on account of his great friendship for John Root. Prettyman was ill-suited to the job. Harriet Monrose, who knew him and his wife, wrote, "His genius was betrayed by lofty and indomitable traits of character which could not yield or compromise, and so his life was a tragedy of inconsequence." The day of the meeting, Prettyman was on the East Coast. The architects proceeded without him. "I was urging everyone on, knowing I had an awful fight against time," Burnham said. "We talked about the colors, and finally the thought came, let us make it all perfectly white." I do not remember who made that suggestion. It might have been one of those things that reached all minds at once. At any rate, I decided it. The Mines Building, designed by Chicago's Solon S. Beeman, was nearly finished. It became the test building. Burnham ordered it painted a creamy white. Prettyman returned and was outraged, Burnham recalled. Prettyman insisted that any decision on color was his alone. "I don't see it that way," Burnham told him. "The decision is mine." "All right," Prettyman said. "I will get out." Burnham did not miss him. He was a brooding sort of man and very cranky, Burnham said. "I let him go, then told Charles McKim that I would have to have a man who could actually take charge of it, and that I would not decide from the point of friendship." McKim recommended the New York painter Francis Millet, who had sat in on the color meeting. A brief period of awkwardness followed over the question of salary. Millet would be delighted to join the fair, a memorandum reported, but regretted extremely that circumstances were such that he must, in a measure, consider the question of compensation. Over dinner in New York at Delmonico's, Burnham agreed to a salary of $15,000, the highest paid to any fair official other than himself. In July, the executive committee formally approved Millet's appointment, but for only half the salary Burnham had offered. By then, however, Millet had fallen for the fair and for Burnham, and would have stayed even if the committee had cut his salary to nothing. Millet quickly proved his worth. After some experimentation, he settled on ordinary white lead and oil as the best paint for staff, then developed a means of applying the paint not by brush, but through a hose with a special nozzle fashioned from a length of gas pipe. The first spray paint. Burnham nicknamed Millet and his paint crews the Whitewash Gang. In the first week of May, a powerful storm dropped an ocean of rain on Chicago and again caused the Chicago River to reverse flow. With its baggage of dead animals and human sewage, the river raced into Lake Michigan with such force that tugboats towing steamships had to wait at the river's mouth until the flow subsided. Again, the sewage threatened the city's water supply. The decaying carcass of a horse was spotted bobbing near one of the intake cribs. This new surge underscored for Burnham the urgency of completing his plan to pipe Waukesha spring water to the fair by opening day. Earlier in July 1891, the exposition had granted a contract for the work to the Hygieia Mineral Springs Company, headed by an entrepreneur named J.E. McElroy. But the company had accomplished little. In March, Burnham ordered Dion Geraldine, his chief construction superintendent, to press the matter with the utmost vigor and see that no delay occurs. Hygieia secured rights to lay its pipe from its spring house in Waukesha through the village itself, but failed to anticipate the intensity of opposition from citizens who feared the pipeline would disfigure their landscape and drain their famous springs. Hygieia's McElroy, under mounting pressure from Burnham, turned to desperate measures. On Saturday evening, May 7th, 1892, McElroy loaded a special train with pipes, picks, shovels, and 300 men and set off for Waukesha to dig his pipeline under cover of darkness. Word of the expedition beat the train to Waukesha. As it pulled into the station, someone rang the village fire bell, and soon a large force of men armed with clubs, pistols, and shotguns converged on the train. Two fire engines arrived, hissing steam, their crews ready to blast the pipe layers with water. One village leader told McElroy that if he went ahead with his plan, he would not leave town alive. Soon, another 1,000 or so townspeople joined the small army at the station. One group of men dragged a cannon from town hall and trained it on Hygieia's bottling plant. After a brief standoff, McElroy and the pipelayers went back to Chicago. Burnham still wanted that water. Workers already had laid pipes in Jackson Park for 200 spring water booths. McElroy gave up trying to run pipes directly into the village of Waukesha. Instead, he bought a spring in the town of Big Bend, 12 miles south of Waukesha, just inside the Waukesha County line. Fair visitors would be able to drink Waukesha spring water after all. That the water came from the county and not the famous village was a subtlety upon which Burnham and McElroy did not dwell. In Jackson Park, everyone became caught up in the accelerating pace of construction. As the buildings rose, the architects spotted flaws in their designs, but found the forward crush of work so overwhelming it threatened to leave the flaws locked in stone, or at least staff. Frank Millett unofficially kept watch over the buildings of the Eastern architects during their lengthy absences from the park, lest some ad hoc decision cause irreparable aesthetic damage. On June 6, 1892, he wrote to Charles McKim, designer of the agriculture building, "You had better write a letter embodying all the ideas of changes you have, because before you know it, they'll have you by the umbilicus. I staved them off from a cement floor in the rotunda today and insisted that you must have brick. It takes no end of time and worry to get a thing settled right, but only a second to have orders given out for a wrong thing to be done. All these remarks are in strict confidence, and I write in this way to urge you to be explicit and flat-footed in your wishes." At the manufacturer's building, workers employed by contractor Francis Agnew began the dangerous process of raising the giant iron trusses that would support the building's roof and create the widest span of unobstructed interior space ever attempted. The workers installed three sets of parallel railroad tracks along the length of the building. Atop these, on rail car wheels or trucks, they erected a traveler, a giant derrick comprised of three tall towers spanned at the top by a platform. Workers using the traveler could lift and position two trusses at a time. Henry Post's design called for 22 trusses, each weighing 200 tons. Just getting the components to the park had required 600 rail cars. On Wednesday, June 1st, exposition photographer Charles Arnold took a photograph of the building to record its progress. Anyone looking at that photograph would have to conclude that the building could not possibly be finished in the 4.5 months that remained until dedication day. The trusses were in place, but no roof. The walls were just beginning to rise. When Arnold took the photograph, hundreds of men were at work on the building, but its scale was so great that none of the men was immediately visible. The ladders that rose from one level of scaffold to the next had all the substance of matchsticks and imparted to the structure an aura of fragility. In the foreground stood mountains of debris. 2 weeks later, Arnold returned for another photograph and captured a very different scene, one of devastation. On the night of June 13th, just after 9 o'clock, another abrupt storm struck the fairgrounds, and this one also seemed to single out the manufacturer's building. A large portion of the building's north end collapsed, and in turn caused the failure of an elevated gallery designed to ring the interior of the building. 100,000 feet of lumber crashed to the floor. Arnold's photograph of the aftermath showed a Lilliputian man, possibly Burnham, standing before a great mound of shattered wood and tangled steel. This, of all buildings. The contractor, Francis Agnew, acknowledged the wall had been inadequately braced, but blamed this condition on Burnham for pushing the men to build too quickly. Now Burnham pushed them even harder. He made good on his threat and doubled the number of men working on the building. They worked at night, in rain, in stifling heat. In August alone, the building took 3 lives. Elsewhere on the grounds, 4 other men died, and dozens more suffered all manner of fractures, burns, and lacerations. The fair, according to one later appraisal, was a more dangerous place to work than a coal mine. Burnham intensified his drive for more power. The constant clash between the Exposition Company and the National Commission had become nearly unbearable. Even the congressional investigators had recognized that the overlapping jurisdiction was a source of discord and needless expense. Their report recommended that Davis's salary be cut in half, a clear sign that the balance of power had shifted. The company and commission worked out a truce. On August 24th, the executive committee named Burnham Director of Works, chief of everything. Soon afterward, Burnham dispatched letters to all his department heads, including Olmsted. I have assumed personal control of the active work within the grounds of the World's Columbian Exposition, he wrote. Henceforward, and until further notice, you will report to and receive orders from me exclusively. In Pittsburgh, the young steel engineer became more convinced than ever that his challenge to the Eiffel Tower could succeed. He asked a partner in his inspection firm, W.F. Granau, to calculate the novel forces that would play among the components of his structure. In engineering parlance, it embodied little dead load, the static weight of immobile masses of brick and steel. Nearly all of it was live load, meaning weight that changes over time, as when a train passes over a bridge. I had no precedent, Granau said. After 3 weeks of intense work, however, he came up with detailed specifications. The numbers were persuasive, even to Burnham. In June, the Ways and Means Committee agreed that the thing should be built. They granted a concession. The next day, the committee revoked it. Second thoughts after a night spent dreaming of freak winds and shrieking steel and 2,000 lives gone in a wink. One member of the committee now called it a monstrosity. A chorus of engineers chanted the thing could not be built, at least not with any margin of safety. Its young designer still did not concede defeat, however. He spent $25,000 on drawings and additional specifications and used these to recruit a cadre of investors that included 2 prominent engineers, Robert Hunt, head of a major Chicago firm, and Andrew Onderdonk, famous for helping construct the Canadian Pacific Railway. Soon, he sensed a change. The new man in charge of the Midway, Saul Bloom, had struck like a bolt of lightning and seemed amenable to just about anything. The more novel and startling, the better. And Burnham had gained almost limitless power over the construction and operation of the fair. The engineer readied himself for a 3rd try. In the 1st week of September 1892, Olmsted and his young party left England for home, departing Liverpool aboard the City of New York. The seas were high, the crossing difficult. Seasickness felled Marion and left Rick perpetually queasy. Olmsted's own health again declined. His insomnia came back. He wrote, "I was more disabled when I returned than when I left." Now, however, he had no time to recuperate. Dedication day was only a month away, and Harry Codman was again ill, incapacitated by the same stomach problem that had struck him during the summer. Olmsted left for Chicago to take over direct supervision of the work while Codman recovered. "I am still tortured a good deal with neuralgia and toothache," Olmsted wrote, "and I am tired and have a growing dread of worry and anxiety." In Chicago, he found a changed park. The mines building was done, as was the fisheries building. Most of the other buildings were well underway, including, incredibly, the giant manufacturer's building, where hundreds of workers swarmed its scaffolds and roof. The building's floor alone had consumed 5 train car loads of nails. Amid all this work, however, the landscape had suffered. Temporary tracks latticed the grounds. Wagons had gouged chasms across paths, roads, and would-be lawns. Litter lay everywhere. A first-time visitor might wonder if Olmsted's men had done any work at all. Olmsted, of course, knew that tremendous progress had been made, but it was the sort that escaped casual notice. Lagoons existed now where once there had been barren land. The elevated sites upon which the building stood had not existed until his grading teams created them. The previous spring, his men had planted nearly everything raised in the exposition's nurseries, plus an additional 200,000 trees, aquatic plants and ferns, and 30,000 more willow cuttings. All this under the direction of his aptly named head gardener, E. Den. In the time left before dedication day, Burnham wanted Olmsted's men to concentrate on cleaning the grounds and dressing them with flowers and temporary lawns of sod, actions that Olmsted understood were necessary, but that clashed with his career-long emphasis on designing for scenic effects that might not be achieved for decades. "Of course, the main work suffers," he wrote. One indisputably positive development had occurred during his absence, however. Burnham had awarded the boat concession to a company called the Electric Launch and Navigation Company, which had produced a lovely electric vessel of exactly the character Olmsted wanted. On dedication day, even the press was polite enough to overlook the stark appearance of the grounds and the unfinished feel of the manufacturer's building. To have done otherwise would have been an act of disloyalty to Chicago and the nation. The dedication had been anticipated nationwide. Francis J. Bellamy, an editor of Youth's Companion, thought it would be a fine thing if on that day all the school children of America, in unison, offered something to their nation. He composed a pledge which the Bureau of Education mailed to virtually every school. It began, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." A great parade brought Burnham and other dignitaries to the manufacturer's building, where a standing army of 140,000 Chicagoans filled the 32-acre floor. Shafts of sunlight struck through the rising mist of human breath. 5,000 yellow chairs stood on the red-carpeted speaker's platform, and in these chairs sat businessmen dressed in black, foreign commissioners and clerics in scarlet, purple, green, and gold. Ex-Mayor Carter Harrison, running now for a 5th term, strode about shaking hands, his black slouch hat raising cheers from supporters in the crowd. At the opposite end of the building was a 5,000-voice choir which sang Handel's Hallelujah Chorus to the accompaniment of 500 musicians. At one point, a spectator recalled, 90,000 people suddenly rose and stood upon their feet and simultaneously waved and fluttered 90,000 snowy pocket handkerchiefs. The air was cut into dusty spirals which vibrated to the great iron-ribbed ceiling. One had a sense of dizziness, as if the entire building rocked. The chamber was so immense that visual signals had to be used to let the chorus know when a speaker had stopped talking and a new song could begin. Microphones did not yet exist, so only a small portion of the audience actually heard any speeches. The rest, with faces contorted from the strain of trying to listen, saw large, distant men gesturing wildly into the sound-killing miasma of whispers, coughs, and creaking shoe leather. Harriet Monroe, the poet who had been John Root's sister-in-law, was there and watched as two of the nation's greatest speakers, Colonel Henry Watterson of Kentucky and Chauncey M. Depew of New York, took turns at the podium, both orators waving their windy words toward a vast, whispering, rustling audience which could not hear. This was a big day for Miss Monroe. She had composed a lengthy poem for the event, her Columbian Ode, and pestered her many powerful friends into having it placed on the day's program. She watched with pride as an actress read it to the few thousand people close enough to hear it. Unlike the majority of the audience, Monroe believed the poem to be rather a brilliant work, so much so that she had hired a printer to produce 5,000 copies for sale to the public. She sold few, and attributed the debacle to America's fading love of poetry. That winter, she burned the excess copies for fuel. Prendergast. On November 28, 1892, Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast, the mad Irish immigrant, selected one of his postal cards. He was 24 years old now, and despite his accelerating mental decline, was still employed by the Inter-Ocean as a delivery contractor. The card, like all the others, was 4 inches wide by 5 inches long, blank on one face, with postal insignia and a printed 1 cent stamp on the other. In this time when writing long letters was everyday practice, men of normal sensibility saw these cards as the most crabbed of media, little better than telegrams, but to Prendergast, this square of stiff paper was a vehicle that gave him voice in the skyscrapers and mansions of the city. He addressed this particular card to A.S. Trude, lawyer. He sketched the letters of the name in large floral script, as if seeking to dispatch the cumbersome duty of addressing the card as quickly as possible before advancing to the message itself. That Prendergast selected Trude to be one of his correspondents was not surprising. Prendergast read widely and possessed a good grasp of the grip car wrecks, murders, and city hall machinations covered so fervently by the city's newspapers. He knew that Alfred S. Trude was one of Chicago's best criminal defense attorneys, and that from time to time he was hired by the state to serve as prosecutor, a practice customary in particularly important cases. Prendergast filled the postcard from top margin to bottom, from edge to edge, with little regard for whether the sentences formed level lines or not. He gripped the pen so tightly it impressed channels into the tips of his thumb and forefinger. "My dear Mr. Trude," he began, "were you much hurt?" An accident, reported in the press, had caused Trude minor injuries. "Your humble servant hereby begs leave to tender you his sincere sympathy, and trusts that while he does not appear before you in person, you nonetheless will not have any doubts as to his real sympathy for you in your misfortunes. You are wished by him a speedy recovery from the results of the accident which you had the misfortune to meet with." He wrote with a tone of familiarity that presumed Trude would consider him a peer. As the note progressed, his handwriting shrank until it seemed like something extruded rather than written. "I suppose, Mr. Trude, that you do understand that the greatest authority on the subject of law is Jesus Christ, and that you also know that the fulfillment of the whole law depends upon the observance of these two commands, thou shalt love God most of all, and your neighbor as yourself. These are the greatest commands, if you please, sir." The note clicked from theme to theme like the wheels of a train crossing a freight yard. Have you ever saw the picture of the fat man who looked for his dog while his dog was at his feet and still did not have the wit to see what was the matter? Have you observed the cat? He did not add a closing and did not sign the note. He simply ran out of room, then posted the card. Trude read the note and at first dismissed it as the work of a crank. The number of troubled men and women seemed to be increasing with each passing year. The jails were full of them, a warden later would testify. Inevitably, some became dangerous, like Charles Guiteau, the man who assassinated President Garfield in Washington. For no clear reason, Trude kept the card.